CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. This month, Democracy Now! Is celebrating our 26th anniversary. That's 26 years of bringing you the stories and voices you won't hear anywhere else. We maintain our editorial independence thanks to you. Please donate today at democracynow.org and help us stay on the air for decades to come. Thank you so much. And remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Nearly 1,000 Negroes are marching silently through the center of Natchez, protesting the bomb-slaying Monday night of civil rights leader, father of five, Walter Jackson.
5 years ago this week, civil rights activist Warless Jackson Sr. was assassinated in Natchez, Mississippi, where he was the treasurer of the NAACP. No one's ever been charged with the 1967 murder. The FBI reopened, then closed the case without filing charges, despite evidence pointing to the involvement of the inner circle of the local KKK. The stories told in the new documentary, American Reckoning. We'll speak to the film's directors and Warless Jackson Sr.'s daughter, who's still waiting for justice.
I received this letter in the mail, and it was a slap in the face. I felt like the FBI brought all this attention out to make themselves look good, and, you know, and our families still suffered.
We first look at the growing calls for Spotify to remove Joe Rogan's podcast from its platform after he promoted misinformation about COVID-19 on his show, and as video resurfaced showing Rogan making repeated racist comments using the N-word over and over again. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The National Archives has asked the Justice Department to investigate Donald Trump's handling of the White House records after officials recovered 15 boxes of materials from Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort that should have been turned over to the federal government. According to the Washington Post, those documents include items that were clearly marked as classified, including several labeled top secret. When the FBI investigated Hillary Clinton in 2016 for possibly mishandling classified information, Trump led chants of lock her up on the campaign trail. It's not clear if the FBI will open a similar probe into Trump's mishandling of documents. Meanwhile, investigators with the House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection have found gaps in White House logs of Trump's phone calls on the day of the Capitol assault. The gaps span a period of time during the attack when Trump is known to have been making phone calls. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is blasting conservative lawmakers for supporting a convoy of truck drivers protesting COVID restrictions and vaccine mandates. Trudeau spoke from Canadian Parliament as truckers organized a third blockade of a port entry into the United States.
People in Windsor are suffering and losing their jobs because they can't get auto parts across the Ambassador Bridge. People in Alberta are seeing shelves empty because they can't get deliveries across the Coutts border crossing. And this Conservative Party that supports these blockades won't even stand up and say, enough is enough, it's time to go home.
Protests have forced automakers, including GM, Ford, and Chrysler, to scale back production at plants in Michigan and Ontario. Organizers of the Canadian truckers' protest have been linked to far-right right and neo-Nazi movements. The convoys inspired similar protests around the world. Here in the U.S., a Department of Homeland Security memo predicts a convoy of anti-vaccine truckers will block roads in major cities in the coming weeks and could disrupt the Super Bowl Sunday and President Biden's State of the Union address on March 1st. President Biden's urging U.S. citizens in Ukraine to leave immediately, saying he would not send troops to rescue them in the event of a Russian invasion.
That's a world war when Americans and Russians start shooting at one another.
Russia has denied it plans to invade Ukraine, but tensions remain high as the involved parties are at a stalemate over Russian demands NATO halt its eastward expansion. As Russia, the U.S., and NATO countries have been beefing up their military presence in Eastern Europe, progressive Democrats in the U.S. are calling for a diplomatic resolution to the crisis. On Thursday, Bernie Sanders spoke on the Senate floor.
No one knows exactly what the human costs of such a war would be. There are estimates, however, that come from our own military and intelligence community that there could be over 50,000 civilian casualties in Ukraine, not to mention millions of refugees flooding neighboring countries as they flee what could be the worst European conflict since World War II.
Meanwhile, the outlet Sludge reports some lawmakers are rushing to increase their stock in energy companies as the U.S. ramps up exports of liquid natural gas to Europe in case Russia cuts off its supply. The New York Times reports President Biden seeking to split up $7 billion in frozen U.S.-held Afghan assets between the families of 9/11 victims and humanitarian assistance for Afghanistan. The move would keep the funds out of Taliban control in line with U.S. policy since last August takeover. Aid groups, including the U.N. and others, have been calling on the Biden administration to release the funds in order to stem a growing economic and humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan. A new report by the Norwegian Refugee Council found civilian casualties in Yemen have nearly doubled since the UN Human Rights Council voted to disband an independent monitoring group. In the 4 months since then, at least 1,535 civilians have been killed in Yemen's civil war. Human rights groups say all parties in the conflict have committed serious violations, including Houthi artillery attacks on civilian areas and Saudi-led coalition airstrikes on hospitals, weddings, and funerals. The Biden administration's approved $5 billion of new weapon sales to Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. The deals include missile defense systems and advanced fighter jets. The State Department also approved the sale this week of nearly $14 billion worth of U.S.-made weapons to Indonesia. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky has proposed a resolution that would cancel the Biden administration's planned weapons sale to Egypt, valued at over $2.5 billion. In an op-ed published Thursday, Paul blasted the government of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi for extrajudicial killings, torture, and harsh crackdowns on activists exercising free speech. Senator Paul wrote, quote, "My resolution to cancel military sales offers a choice whether the United States will side with the Egyptian people or with their oppressors," he said. In Somalia, al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for a bombing Thursday that killed six people and wounded at least a dozen others in the capital, Mogadishu. The attack targeted a minibus full of delegates involved in Somalia's parliamentary elections. In Mexico, Eber Lopez, the director of the online news site RCP Noticias, was shot and killed at his office in the southern state of Oaxaca on Thursday. Police say they've arrested two suspects in the murder. Lopez is the fifth media worker assassinated in Mexico so far this year alone. In Costa Rica, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights heard oral arguments Wednesday in a historic case of an indigenous community accusing the Guatemalan government of violating their ancestral and collective land rights. Maya Kekchi residents of Agua Caliente in the eastern Guatemalan region of El Estor have fought to obtain formal titles for their lands for over 40 years in a struggle to protect their communities from extractive industries. Rodrigo Tot, a Kekchi leader, winner of the Golden Environmental Prize in 2017, testified in front of the court about the repression he and other land defenders have faced from the Guatemalan government.
Como resultado de toda esta lucha, We have faced many threats in response to our resistance. The most painful was the loss of my son.
El más doloroso, la pérdida de mi hijo. Se equivocaron los que asesinaron a mi hijo.
His killers thought I'd stay silent, but what's motivated me the most is that since my son's assassination, more leaders have stepped up, like me, to fight for our land.
In Haiti, police fired tear gas on striking factory workers in Port-au-Prince for a second straight day Thursday. The workers are demanding a pay increase to at least $15 a day. As Haiti grapples with rising inflation, ongoing political and security crises, several reports on social media say at least one person was killed. Workers say they'll continue their strike next week if needed. Dozens of Cameroonian asylum seekers who were deported by the U.S. government between 2019 and last year face serious human rights violations, including torture, rape, and arbitrary arrests upon returning to Cameroon. That's according to a new Human Rights Watch report that traced the whereabouts of at least 80 Cameroonians expelled from the U.S. despite saying they feared for their lives. This is one of the deported asylum seekers.
I want to tell the American government that sending me back to Cameroon, that is harm, has seriously impacted my life, and that I still need their protection and assistance because my life is seriously still in danger.
Many of the asylum seekers also accused Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, of medical neglect and violent mistreatment while in custody. President Biden pitched his plan to cut prescription drug costs during a speech at a community college in Virginia Thursday.
Nearly 30% have skipped doses of essential drugs they're supposed to take. Others have simply not filled prescriptions that the doctor had given them. Tried to use over-the-counter drugs or pills cut in half because they can't afford the cost of their prescription. This is the United States of America, for God's sake. That's just wrong. It's simply wrong.
Biden's address came shortly after an inflation report was released showing a 7.5% increase in consumer prices over the past year, the steepest hike in 40 years. Earlier this week, Republican Senator Mike Crapo blocked a bill from Senators Bernie Sanders and Amy Klobuchar that would slash prescription drug prices by half. And a newly declassified letter written by two senators reveals the CIA has been secretly and illegally carrying out a mass surveillance program on U.S. citizens and residents for years. Senators Ron Wyden and Martin Einrich called in their letter from April 2021 for more details about the CIA program to be released and said it was, quote, entirely outside the statutory framework that Congress and the public believe govern this collection and without any of the judicial, congressional, or even executive branch oversight that comes from Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act collection. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, calls are growing for Spotify to remove Joe Rogan's podcast from its platform after he promoted misinformation about COVID-19 on his show, and his video resurfaced showing Rogan making repeated racist comments using the N-word over and over again. Stay with us.
Find the cost of freedom. swallow you. Lay your body down. Find the cost of freedom.
Find the cost of freedom by Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. Neil Young's former bandmates have also asked to remove their music from Spotify in protest of Joe Rogan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Calls are growing for the audio streaming app Spotify to remove Joe Rogan's podcast from its platform after he promoted misinformation about COVID-19 on his show and his video resurfaced showing Rogan making repeated racist comments. Last Friday, the Grammy-winning singer India Arie joined other artists who've pulled their music from Spotify as she shared a viral video showing Rogan using the N-word on his show 24 times.
Like, you know, the thing.
Yes. Saying the word.
I already said D is just like
saying
she's calling you a like this boy that he's a but starts calling them.
Other resurfaced videos show Joe Rogan saying black people have different brains and comparing a neighborhood with no white people to the Planet of the Apes. Rogan posted an apology video on his Instagram account last weekend in which he addressed the video supercut.
I'm making this video to talk about the most regretful and shameful thing that I've ever had to talk about publicly. There's a video that's out that's a compilation of me saying the N-word. It's a video that's made of clips taken out of context of me of 12 years of conversations on my podcast, and it's all smushed together, and it looks horrible, even to me. Now, I know that to most people, there's no context where a white person is ever allowed to say that word, never mind publicly on a podcast. And I agree with that now. I haven't said it in years.
In a video response Wednesday, India Arie said she thought some of Rogan's apology was disingenuous and added Spotify's built on the back of the music streaming, so they take this money that's built from streaming and they pay this guy $100 million, but they pay us 0.003% of a penny, she said. Arie also cited writer Roxane Gay and others in clarifying she wanted Spotify to curate its content, not censor what it's on its platform.
Censorship is being at the threat of loss of life or freedom for your words. No one's being censored here. She said this is not censorship, this is about curation. Curation meaning choosing what you want in a space, choosing the space you want around you. Curation. This is not about censorship. This is about curation. And so Spotify is making a choice about the space they choose to curate. I and other creators are making choices about the space we want to curate. My conversation is not about Joe Rogan. It is not about Spotify. It is about my integrity and my dignity.
Spotify has now deleted scores of past episodes of Rogan's podcast, but Spotify CEO Daniel Ek has refused to cancel Rogan's exclusive contract. In a memo to Spotify workers, Ek wrote, quote, "Canceling voices is a slippery slope," unquote. The watchdog outlet Media Matters published a compilation of times Joe Rogan has spoken about the impunity he operates with at Spotify. This is a part of it.
Did they know that you're Jewish?
Yes.
Now? Well, then they're.
You can't say that.
But I did.
Yeah, but you're not allowed.
But I'm on Spotify. You can get away with it. That's just because the world has gotten more controversial. Yeah. I've changed nothing. And Spotify has asked me to change nothing.
But
They've never come to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kudos to them.
No, they've been amazing.
Yeah.
I'm very happy with them. Spotify has given me no pushback whatsoever. Spotify didn't seem, I mean, I had to take a chance, but they didn't seem like they were going to censor me in any way.
For more, we're joined by Alex Patterson, senior researcher for the LGBTQ program at Media Matters and their self-described Joe Rogan watchdog. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Alex. You've said Rogan has 11 million listeners per episode. You've watched hundreds of episodes. I want to begin with the racism, with the N-word. And of course, that's also linked to COVID misinformation. But can you talk about what he has said over the years, the deal he made with Spotify? I mean, this goes way back. Spotify had to know what he was saying, what they were buying.
Absolutely. When Spotify cut Rogan a $100 million check to come on their platform exclusively, they knew what they were getting. And Rogan has delivered on that. He's continued to spread anti-trans hate, racist tropes, and sexist remarks on his podcast. I heard you play his apology video, but this week on his podcast, he said he was happy that that video came to light, and he called it a political hit job. He's made it clear that he doesn't have any intention of changing what the lies and hate he spreads on his podcast, and it's far past time Spotify came to the plate and actually moderated the content on its platform.
So tell us a little more about Joe Rogan, for those who have never heard about him, how this whole story exploded.
Joe Rogan is a comedian and MMA commentator who rose to stardom in the United States, first through acting in comedy, then he was the host of Fear Factor, and now he has the most popular podcast in the world. He has 11 million listeners per episode, which is about four times as many viewers as broadcast cable TV news shows like Sean Hannity or Tucker Carlson receive per night. So what Spotify has on its hands is a serial misinformer that's reaching a huge, huge audience. And he's not only spread hateful remarks on his podcast, but he regularly lies about the pandemic. Over the past year and a half, he's encouraged people not to get vaccinated, and he's repeatedly lied that mRNA vaccines are a form of gene therapy. And it's clear he's one of the most prominent COVID-19 misinformers in the U.S., and Spotify is completely failing to do anything about it.
You've reported that, as you said, that Rogan is one of the most prominent misinformers about COVID in the media landscape. In April, he said on his podcast he believes healthy 21-year-olds don't need to get vaccinated.
Yeah, it's safe to get vaccinated. I've said, yeah, I think for the most part, it's safe to get vaccinated. I do. But if you're like 21 years old and you say to me, should I get vaccinated? I go, no. Yeah. Are you healthy? Are you a healthy person? Like, look, don't do anything stupid, but you should take care of yourself. You should, if you're a healthy person and you're exercising all the time and you're young and you're eating well, like, I don't think you need to worry about this.
Alex Patterson, your response.
The clip speaks for itself. This isn't a symptom of Joe Rogan's podcast. This is something he's doing almost every single day. He's also lied that President Biden perhaps didn't get vaccinated on live TV because he could have died. And he recently said that children don't need to get vaccinated. He's also pushed unproven and potentially dangerous treatments on his podcast. He was one person who made ivermectin pretty much a national debate overnight. And Spotify
explain what ivermectin is.
Yeah, ivermectin is a widely available prescription that people have started to take to try to treat COVID-19. But largely, when you look at the research, there's no proven methods for it to treat COVID. And what's more, it can be taken in excess and have dangerous outcomes.
I want to go to a few days ago, January 25th, Joe Rogan hosting a Canadian conservative public figure, Jordan Peterson, on his podcast. Peterson spent almost an hour attempting to discredit climate science.
We still have a weird idea of nuclear because of the several, you know, whether it's Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, there's been a few disasters.
Yeah, more people Fukushima. Die every year from solar energy than die from nuclear.
Who dies from solar?
Of course. Guess how you die from solar?
Sunburn?
No, you fall off the roofs when you're installing it.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's gravity.
Right. Yeah, gravity. Gravity. Yeah. And, you know, that's a good example of unintended consequences.
Alex Patterson, if you can respond.
One thing I think that clip shows is that Rogan's episode at any point in time has the ability to become a lightning rod for right-wing misinformation. There we see clear lies about climate change. And also in that episode, Rogan and Peterson claimed that Michael Eric Dyson isn't actually black and spread other racist tropes. And what has Spotify done in response to that episode? Nothing. Potentially 11 million people took that directly and take it for truth. And what we're seeing is that this is repeatedly happening on Rogan's show. And I've listened to over 350 hours of his podcast in the last year, and we're just now seeing people take action against it. And until Spotify does something, I think we'll continue to see artists and content creators leave the platform.
Alex, let me ask you about Spotify saying they're keeping Rogan. They're not going to censor him. That's a slippery slope, the CEO X says. And also to repeat what India Arie, the musician, said, Spotify built on the back of the music streaming. So they take this money that's built from streaming and they pay this guy $100 million, but they pay us 0.003% of a penny?
It's simple. Money talks. And right now, Spotify is showing that above all else, it wants to profit off Joe Rogan's lies about the pandemic and his hateful bigotry. And it sends clearly a message to artists of who's most important here.
In 2020, you shared a clip from Rogan's podcast when he lied and claimed left-wing people, I think he put it as, were starting forest fires, which led to outrage that led to Rogan apologizing. But Spotify didn't take any action.
Yeah, CEO Spotify Daniel Ek has stood by Rogan time and time again. When Rogan lies about vaccines, when he spreads lies straight from Fox News. An additional point I want to make is that it's not just Rogan on the platform. Media Matters has identified an entire network of right-wing pundits and anti-vaccine skeptics who've spread harmful misinformation on the podcast. Steven Crowder is one. He hosts a podcast that is played on Spotify, and he recently proposed ideas of Omicron parties. That episode is still on Spotify, despite the platform having rules that explicitly prohibit people from encouraging others to get infected with COVID-19.
You've said that Rogan evades accountability by inviting others on to voice them false or extremely discriminatory ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd love to point out he has a really cunning way of avoiding any accountability. When you look at Rogan's podcast, it's comedians, scientists, professors, and then a ton of right-wing and far-right pundits, people like Alex Jones, like Ben Shapiro. And Rogan knows what he's doing. He knows the sort of rhetoric these people are going to spread on his podcast. And then on the rare occasion he is actually held to account in the media, he has a really cunning way of avoiding any accountability. He claims to be a, quote, moron. And that's not true. He knows exactly what he's doing here. And both Rogan and Spotify know the influence he has.
What is Media Matters calling for?
We're calling for Spotify to publish and enforce robust rules around misinformation on its podcast, on its platform. If you look at Spotify's current platform rules, it makes two mentions of COVID-19. It doesn't say anything about masks, distancing, preventative measures, or downplaying the pandemic. And then in part of that, what I mentioned is Spotify has to actually enforce these rules. This week, Joe Rogan downplayed the severity of children being raped. He said it would be fine for 13-year-old boys to have sex with adult women. Spotify doesn't allow content that suggests it's okay to groom children for sex, but Spotify hasn't done anything in response. We're just really asking them to take accountability for the content that they're creating.
Alex Patterson, we thank you for being with us, senior researcher for the LGBTQ program at Media Matters and their self-described Joe Rogan watchdog. Coming up, American Reckoning, a new documentary about unsolved crimes from the civil rights era in Natchez, Mississippi. Stay with us.
Black leaves on the Mississippi. Black leaves in the Mississippi fire.
ship be quiet. Black leaves on the Mississippi land. And we've got garden, garden. We've got sons and daughters. We've got grit and glory. We've got modern stories. We've got strength like towers. We've got hope and power. God made woman with an iron's hand, placed her up on heaven's land.
Black Leaves by Kirby. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. It's Black History Month. This month marks 55 years since the assassination of an NAACP leader in the city of Natchez, Mississippi. On February 27, 1967, Warlist Jackson Sr. died when a bomb attached to his car exploded. At the time, Jackson was the treasurer of the NAACP in Natchez. He died on his way home from working, his first day of work at the Armstrong Tire and Rubber Plant. He had just been promoted to a job never held by a black man before. Warlist Jackson Sr. was 36 years old, the father of five. The FBI suspected the assassination was carried out by the inner circle of the Ku Klux Klan, known as the Silver Dollar Group. But no one was ever charged in his murder. This tragic story is told in a new documentary that examines the civil rights struggle in Natchez. It's called American Reckoning. This is an excerpt from the film featuring Warlist Jackson Sr.'s son, Warlist Jackson Jr., who recalls his father's assassination. At the time, he was just 8 years old.
I stood right here, working on my bicycle in front of my house. I was trying to get my banana seat right, and I had a big, nice, big, fat tire on the back of it. I used to see those guys riding those choppers. Man, I wanted to make my bike like that, too, a little 20-inch bicycle. I heard an explosion in my mind. Like, what is that? I never heard anything like that before. I jumped on my bicycle. I shot right down there and shot straight to this here, street here. You can look straight down the street to MLK. I'm noticing people outside of their houses, you know, and I just rode up there and started looking in. I saw a gentleman laying in the street. Not knowing who he was, and seeing the truck, knowing who truck that was, and not being able to connect the dots together. I saw a shoe that he was wearing, and I grabbed that shoe and came to the house. Later, I heard from my mother as I grew up, I had come back with his flesh in his shoe.
An excerpt from the new documentary, American Reckoning. The film goes on to look at how the community in Natchez, Mississippi, responded to the assassination of Warlist Jackson Sr.
Nearly 1,000 Negroes are marching silently through the center of Natchez, protesting the bomb-slaying Monday night of civil rights leader, father of five, Warlist Jackson.
Jackson, an official of the local NAACP, had left his new job last night at the Armstrong Rubber Company, presumably en route home. The cab and the truck were completely demolished.
My father looked out for the black community in this town. And believe me, this community loved my father. He was just a god to me.
My father sacrificed his life so that we can have a better community, and you don't have to be afraid But will we ever get justice?
They've been killing us here for 400 years.
Right.
It's got to come to a head. And we're sick and tired of that. We done built this country.
As soon as the white people realize that we aren't going nowhere, the better it's going to be for all of us. Wake up, white people. Before it's too late.
An excerpt from the new documentary Frontline and Retro Report's new documentary American Reckoning, premiering Tuesday, February 15th on PBS and online at pbs.org/frontline, YouTube, and in the PBS video app. The project is supported by WNET's Chasing the Dream. We're joined now by three guests, Denise Ford Jackson, the daughter of Warless Jackson Sr., as well as the film's directors, Brad Lichtenstein and Yoruba Richin. It's great to have everyone with us. And Yoruba, former producer at Democracy Now!, great honor to have you back as well. Yoruba, I want to begin with you talking about this just devastating story that is many storylines put together. It is the story of a city in this country where at the highest levels, the conspiracy of the government against the black population of Natchez. And the fact that we did not, many people in this country, I should say, had not heard of Warless Jackson, let alone his assassination, his murder.
Absolutely. Thank you, Amy, for having us on. It's a story that when Brad told me about, Brad had been developing it, and he'll tell you about that for a couple of years before asking me to partner with him on this project. But when he told me about it, I was, you know, immediately intrigued and interested in this story that I had never heard of. I'm always love projects where I am learning something and uncovering a story that hadn't been told. And then when I saw the trailer that Brad initially made, and I saw that the amazing archival footage that really documented what was happening in Natchez and the murder of Warless Jackson Sr., I had never seen, you know, this archival footage. I'd never seen, the documentation of the story that was happening, like, in real time.
Let me say something about that, and I want to bring Brad in. I mean, this is so astounding, the level of detail of footage you have from over half a century ago documenting the movement in Natchez. And you have a direct link to the story as well, as you were an intern with John Lewis when he was running for Congress. And John, Congressmember John Lewis, the civil rights icon, figures into this story.
Yes. Good morning. And thank you for asking me, because I love to remember my relationship with Mr. Lewis, who I met when I was 15 years old. I worked in his campaign, and then we became lifelong friends. And he's the author of the Emmett Till Act. And that's really how this project got started. I was visiting him in his office in Washington, and we were talking about different ideas for films. Secretary Brenda Jones told me about the cold cases that were being re-examined under the Emmett Till Act, and that might be a thing to focus on. And then I learned about the story of Warless Jackson Sr., and then discovered that filmmaker Ed Pincus and his filmmaking partner David Newman had actually been in Natchez at the exact same time making the movie Black Natchez, and that there were hours and hours and hours of outtakes, and that they had returned right after the assassination of Mr. Jackson and started to try to make a sequel. And so there's something like 30 hours of footage that never saw the light of day. And then we discovered that that footage had been collected into a collection at the Amistad Research Center and was actually going to be available to use, which is what gives us the ability to tell this story in real time, even though, as you pointed out, it happened over half a century ago.
So I want to bring Denise in, but first to the documentary again, American Reckoning. This excerpt begins with an archival clip from 1965 in Natchez.
to the school board for the Natchez Adams County Public Schools. The undersigned hereby petition your board to initiate racial desegregation of the public schools under your jurisdiction and control.
By late August, the NAACP filed a lawsuit against the schools for desegregation.
We would further request that the names of those signed this petition not be made public in order to protect the signers from possible reprisals and harassment.
There was a fear and a resentment of desegregation of the schools at the time in the white community. There was just wild rumors of what was going to happen if the blacks took over.
My dad and the Klan didn't want black people in our schools, offices, anything. They wanted to get it stopped at all costs.
George Metcalf, president of the Natchez chapter of the NAACP, was critically injured in Natchez this afternoon when dynamite hidden beneath the hood of his car exploded when he turned on the ignition.
When the bomb went off on the hood of his vehicle, a lot of that metal and brass just went back into his face.
After the bombing of Metcalf's car, the black community explodes.
After the 1965 bombing of the car of the Natchez NAACP leader George Metcalf, who did survive that, civil rights activists organized a massive boycott against white-owned businesses. This clip features Charles Evers, the brother of Medgar Evers, who was assassinated 2 years earlier in 1963 at his home in Jackson, Mississippi.
You tell the good mayor that I said he can get all that injunction, conjunction, and some junction he want to get. We're not going to spend our money with him anymore. Tell him how people can give him decent jobs and recognize him as individuals and human beings.
We decided we're going to boycott every white store in Natchez.
Downtown Natchez is under a strict boycott by nearly half the population. The boycott began when the Negroes failed to get their 12 demands from city officials.
The mayor at the time had a whole shopping center. Me and Nasser, we shut his whole damn shopping center down.
Keep the white man's dollar out of his pocket, and you can control him instead of him controlling you.
That last speaker was James Stokes, a spokesperson of the armed African-American self-defense group Deacons of Defense. Now let's turn to another clip of American Reckoning about the protest in Natchez in 1965.
There are these marches at night that are taking place. 300 marchers are arrested for parading without a permit.
I'm the chief of police, J.T. Robinson. If you don't disperse and go home, I will have to put you under arrest. Parading without a permit, which is in violation of the city ordinance.
There's another attempt to march. 150 are arrested. And then yet another march is attempted.
Get back on the inside, please!
We walked that about a block before the police stopped. Dead buses. How many pictures out there? It took us to Boston, Mississippi.
Once they're at Parchment, it's cold, they were stripped naked, they were given a laxative.
They made us all drink about an 8-ounce glass. They said, well, you gonna drink this medicine or else get beat to death.
Again, a clip from American Reckoning. And now we're going to Denise Ford Jackson, featured in the film The Daughter of Warless Jackson Sr., the treasurer of the NAACP chapter in Natchez, who was assassinated 2 years later from what we saw in that clip in a bombing by the Ku Klux Klan. Denise, it's 55 years later, but our deepest condolences go to you and your family as you live this every day of your lives. It is so clear in this documentary.
Yes, it is. And thank you for having me this morning.
So, you know, if you can talk about, I mean, the story of Parchman, your mother was in Parchman, right? Your mother was one of those arrested. She, like your dad, was unrelenting in trying to challenge the racist system. And they describe this horror of being put in these cold cells, stripped naked and forced to drink laxatives so that, and they obviously had no access to bathrooms. And this is pure torture. What happened to your mother after this?
Well, she became ill. She formed a illness that kept her bedridden. And that made my dad had to take care of the five children, cook for us, comb my hair. And then once she was able to, she came up with a sickness called lupus, which nothing kept her down, but she was able to, you know, regain her strength back. And she was able to do what she needed to do for the family.
So she's ill. She's come out of Parchman. Your father's continuing to organize. That was 65. Your father's assassinated in 67. Tell us what happened. And did you I mean, you're a little kid at the time, but this ominous sense of the targeting of your family.
The only thing I can relate to is that I know that my dad was under a lot of pressure, being threatened with, you know, being able to, he wanted to accept a promotion at Armstrong. He discussed it with my mom. My mom told him not to accept the position, but he was a man that didn't take no for an answer. They were trying to make a stand here in the county, in the city of Natchez, to let people know that, you know, we as a Black was just as capable of handling these supervisor positions as a white man, even though they said these positions were for white only. But my father took a stand to make our community better. And my mother was one who was objected to it, but he wouldn't take no. He didn't, he wouldn't accept the word no. He said, I'm gonna take this stand because it was, it gave him a 5 cent raise to help him with the five children that, you know, that he was trying to raise.
So Frontline and Retro Report, this documentary that Brad and Yoruba have made, also taps into the groundbreaking reporting of Stanley Nelson, another Stanley Nelson of the South, who investigated the allegations of the involvement of this Ku Klux Klan. You can't really call it an offshoot. I think the inner circle of, you know, sort of the white collar of the white sheets known as the Silver Dollar Group. This clip begins with Leland Boyd, the son of a Klan member.
I think my dad was probably on the foundation of the formation of the Silver Dollar Club. We would go in a restaurant, and there would be several people sitting in there. And my dad walked up, and he dropped a silver dollar on the table and says, does that have a familiar ring to it? And the guy sitting at the table said, yeah, that sounds like freedom.
I don't know how to term them, and this is like a crude term, but if you had an all-star Klan team, that would be it. They would be in the Pro Bowl. A Silver Dollar Group member would be the kind of guy that thought wearing a robe was silly, who thought burning crosses was silly, who rejected the old Klan because they weren't achieving anything.
He kept his dynamite and hand grenades in the house, so I saw them. You just hear little things about, we gotta take care of business kind of thing.
in the record, you would have some of these members of the Silver Dollar Group going back and forth across the Mississippi River, supporting each other with these very nefarious activities.
They were very quick to extreme violence. They felt very comfortable slaughtering people and knowing they can get away with it.
In that clip, we heard from the children of two Silver Dollar Group members. The last speaker was Cynthia Deedle, who is the former FBI Civil Rights Unit Chief, charged with trying to solve some of these cold cases that dated back decades. Bragg Lichtenstein, let's go back to you. What you learned, what the family learned, I mean, this amazing meeting that Denise, you and your brother and sister had with Stanley Nelson, the white reporter in Natchez who really took on these cold cases. Brad.
Right. Stanley actually started writing about these cold cases in 2008, right at the beginning of the Till Act. And it really was because he realized he worked across the street practically from where a different murder had taken place right across the river in Vidalia and Faraday, Louisiana. And he got curious and he realized that if he didn't know anything about it, at least probably most white people didn't know the stories. And he started digging into the cases. And of course, he met the Jackson family and, you know, had talked to them some over the years. And really, he provided the full story, which the family never could get from law enforcement, whether it was local law enforcement or federal or the FBI.
Tell us, Denise, about that meeting that you have with Stanley Nelson, with your brother Warless, and with your sister, as he lays out for you who exactly he believes killed your father and how he did it.
It was one of the most amazing meetings that we've had, because back in '67, when my mom was living and tried to find out information, she was given documents that had been redacted. Everybody's name was scratched out. She kept going back to the law enforcement. Even the FBI came and told her. They came to assist the local police. And from there, we never received any names or anything, but meeting with Stanley Nelson, he was able to give us to give me more closure to my daddy's death than the people here in Natchez, Mississippi were able to give her. And I hats off to Stanley for the job that he had done. Even the documents that we received from the FBI, you know, was redacted, and we still didn't know anything. So I just appreciate the work that he did, because he gave us insight.
And talk about who you understand killed him. I mean, there's a broader question, like, it's not one person. But the person who put the bomb on the left clicker of his car so that when he turned left, they knew when he came from the factory, he would have to make a left turn into the black community. And it was set for, they believed he'd be going home at a time when all the kids were outside and would have killed so many. But he had to work overtime, so it was like 8 at night. And so when he makes a left turn, the kids aren't out. It just kills him. Who that man was of the white dollar, of the Silver Dollar Group?
Stanley found out it was Ed Glover.
Red. Yes.
Somebody that we didn't know, I don't know.
Who later died?
Someone who's
course.
Been.
Right. Who later died, right.
He had been dead for a while, even before the Emmett Till Act was passed. He had been dead.
And I want to go to the Emmett Till Act, because now we're talking about the closure of all of these cases. This is a clip from American Reckoning about the FBI closing its investigation into your dad's murder, into the murder of Warless Jackson Sr. This is your brother, Warless Jackson Jr.
It was an FBI agent that knocked on the door. I opened the door. He said, I'm looking for Warless Jackson Jr. He went back to his vehicle and gave me that letter.
I received this letter in the mail, and it was a slap in the face. I felt like the FBI brought all this attention out to make themselves look good, and, you know, and our families still suffered. I often tell myself nothing will ever survive over here because of the prejudiceness that happened in this building. A lot of sadness, a lot of hurt.
People are going to be frustrated if someone isn't convicted, if someone isn't arrested. But at some point, a determination has to be made to close the case. We've talked to everyone who could possibly have any real information. How many times are we going to reinvestigate? There's no more value in asking more questions.
Yoruba Richen, we're going to end with you. So you have this Emmett Till law that John Lewis really authored and pushed through. 150 cases, 125 of them closed with not one indictment. And this goes right to Natchez, which is the microcosm of what we're seeing today. If you could talk about whether, in fact, this really ends things, or isn't this the case for reparations or for a kind of lawsuit that is a conspiracy of the entire state? I mean, Parchman was not one guy putting a bomb in a car. It was the state going after all those who protested injustice in Natchez.
Yes, I think that the fact that no one has been indicted for Borlase's case or for these other cases shows that the limits of the justice system in holding people accountable for crimes that happened many years ago. I think it's important to note that we found out that Congressman Lewis, he wanted a larger thing, not just for the Justice Department to open up these cases, but he was really looking for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission that would, in the vein of South Africa, where all these crimes would come to light, where people had to come and talk and air what happened and get at the truth. Of course, he wasn't able to do that. I mean, we live in an extremely polarized country where, you know, talking the truth about this stuff is, you know, that people don't want it to happen. We see that now with what's going on with this critical race theory ridiculousness. But all that to say is that I think this does open up a case for reparations, which we are now talking about in a real way for the first time, and looking at what these families deserve. What is justice for these families? Reparations, mental health, you know, stuff to make them able to deal with this trauma that has happened, that we see with Denise, that we see with Warless Jr. What kind of services can we provide? So we really need to have that conversation. Because it's true, these people are dead, you know, for the most part. I mean, for the crimes that were committed long ago. So how else can we repair the damage that was done and that generational damage? And I think that is about reparations and other services that can provide hope and help for these families.
Yoruba, you're premiering this film at the Lemley in Los Angeles, and then next week it's going to premiere on PBS. And I'm wondering what you want people to take away from this.
I want people to take away, to understand that, first off, we didn't get to talk much about the Deacons for Defense, but that the civil rights movement, or the Black freedom struggle, as I say, is not just reduced to a nonviolent strategy, and that the Deacons for Defense were one of many organizations that fought back and protected their community. And that is also how rights and were won in many different communities. So I want people to understand that. And I want people to take away and to find out more about the history that has been erased.
We have 5 seconds.
Yes, to find out more about the history that's been erased, and also white people especially, because we're at a critical moment in this country where they're trying to erase our history.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, Yoruba Rich and Bragg Lichtenstein and Denise Ford Warless.
Tune in to CKUT 90.3 FM, Tuesdays, 3 p.m. to 5 p.m., for a special Black History Month edition of the Montreal Sessions. The month kicks off on February 1st with the best in reggae and soca with your hosts, Production Sounds and Soca Head. Week 2, February 8th, Wizzy Moonchaser, host of The Morning Detour, broadcast live from DG Kicks, a sneaker store in NDG. Final 2 weeks, 15th and 22nd, are hosted by Stephen Ziplocks Hennessy, educator, creator,
and part of the Ill Groove Garden team. Don't miss it.